Thank you very much, Mr. Bourne. And you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. I appreciate all those undeserved but nice things you said. And Mr. Bourne was a little brief about his own part in the last campaign. It's funny how things can come about. The truth of the matter is, if someone had delivered an automobile faster than they did on a parking lot, maybe there wouldn't have been a television broadcast, because that's where it started, after a banquet, standing out in the parking lot waiting for our cars. And then, as his wife said, she said, "Where did my husband go?" And as it turned out, he went into a newly formed committee meeting at that moment, and out of it came the campaign effort. Well, you know, this has been a kind of a world and a new world for me. Incidentally, I don't mean to complain about anything that's happened here tonight. I was a little surprised that the governor wasn't on hand. But I can understand his reluctance to leave Sacramento. He doesn't dare leave Unruh in the office alone. You know, in this new world of politics, my friend George Murphy, after the last campaign, told me some things that had happened. It was a wonderful world to him. He said after one campaign speech, a little somewhat elderly lady came up to him, took his hand in both of hers, and very sweetly smiled and said, "I remember you when you were George Murphy." And then she smiled just as sweetly and said, "I think your speech was simply superfluous." And Murph, not wanting to be topped, smiled equally sweetly, and he said, "Thank you very much. I'm thinking of having it published posthumously." And she topped him. She said, "I can hardly wait." Well, you know, in this world of politics, though, I think that while it's a controversial world, as almost everything is, back through the years, I've had to apologize for almost every speech I ever made on the basis that it was controversial. I knew there were people present who'd probably disagree with some of the things I said. And then just to prove that everything is, you know, there was a man knocked on a door one day, and a small boy answered the door, and the man says, "Your father home?" The kid said, "No." And he says, "Your mother home?" The boy said, "No." And kind of nonplussed, the man said, "Well, son, I'm your uncle on your father's side." And the kid says, "Well, I guess you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're on the wrong side." But, for example, who among us would complain right now at the efforts put forth by the Democratic leadership and the legislature in Washington to get the voting bill? After all, a party that's made it possible for warehouses and tombstones and empty lots to vote by now should be getting around to people. I was in Washington not too long ago, and it was just twilight, and I rode down Pennsylvania Avenue past the White House. It was wonderful to see it all lighted up now that the election is over. He has to leave the lights on. It's the only way he can read those old Republican campaign speeches and find out what to do next in Vietnam. But seriously, 100 years ago, an Englishman, Lord Macaulay, wrote to an American friend. Lord Macaulay didn't think too much of our experiment over here. And he said to his American friend, "In the 5th century A.D., Rome, ancient Rome, was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns." He said, "In the mid-20th century, and that's the approximate period we're in now," he said, "your republic will be fearfully plundered, but with this difference. Rome's barbarians came from without her borders. Yours will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions." Perhaps what he had in mind was something that had been said much earlier, and I've quoted this before, and perhaps many of you have heard me, but it's so pertinent today. A professor, Alexander Fraser Teitler, who commented on democracy, he said, "It cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship." And when he said that, he wasn't talking about our modern-day America. He was commenting, we were then colonials of Britain. He was commenting on what had destroyed the Athenian Republic more than 2,000 years before. Again, to go back 100 years, the great French philosopher de Tocqueville, said the end of freedom comes when the party in power learns it can perpetuate itself through taxation. Well, what does happen to freedom when the executive branch of government can use the money taken from the people in order to coerce the people? 4.5 years ago, we were told to let us begin. And more recently, let's get moving. Well, we began at a new frontier, and now we're face to face with a great society. And along the way, we've added $30 billion to our debt. We've decreased our gold holdings to the point that there's concern for the solvency of our currency. And now we learn that we'll carry coins in our pockets that will no longer be worth their weight in silver. We've discovered that every family with an income of less than $3,000 a year is poverty-stricken. But each American family's share of government expense today is $3,300 if it was prorated. The farmer's net income has dropped, but their debt in relation to income has reached the all-time high, higher even than on the eve of the 1929 Depression. $2.86 the farmer owes for every dollar of income he has coming in. The crime rate is up 30%, and so is the rate of business failures. And 4.5 years ago, there were no daily casualty lists, no wives and mothers receiving wires that began, "We regret to inform you." In the last campaign, we found our opponents presenting themselves as conservatives. They actually presented themselves as such in the sense that they would make no drastic change, that we could continue what had become an easy and placid way of life. They would, in short, maintain the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. We, on the other hand, were presented as radicals who would bring about some great upheaval, some drastic change in the way of life. Well, now the wraps are off the great society, and a multitude of messages have made it plain that we're to have the welfare state with an unprecedented federalization of American life. Professor Teitler's loose fiscal policy is at hand. Our government spends $260 million a day, $10 million a day more than they were spending a year ago. And on last June 30th, the Congress raised the debt limit for the fifth time in 4 years. Here in California, we've been handed the biggest budget in the history of our state and the biggest budget of any of the 50 states, bigger than $4 billion. We were told it was a bare bones budget, and now we know whose bones are bare. 2 years ago, when it was $3.25 billion, it was called austerity. Last year, he referred to a $3 2/3 billion budget as frugal. It took California 100 years to reach a $1 billion budget, and only 9 years to double it, and only 5 years to double that. And you wonder if we're supposed to try for eight, and how soon we're to reach it. We're among the top 10 industrial states, and we rank number one among those states in combined state and local taxes. They amount to $420 a year for every man, woman, and child in our state. And we're told that all of this is due to the increase in population. Well, no one denies that as the population increases, the workload and the need for public service increases proportionately. But during the period in which we've doubled our population, state expenditures have gone up 10 times as much. And since this administration took office in 1959, our income, yours and mine, has only gone up 11%, but personal income tax collections have skyrocketed 143%, and property taxes up 41%. Personal exemptions have been reduced, and the franchise tax on business increased, and emergencies each year have been met not by tax reform, not by any sensible permanent policy to meet our problems, but by one-time tax windfalls or expedients, such as eliminating the installment collection of personal and corporate income taxes. And now, faced with a deficit once again, we're told in this moment the same kind of a stopgap, and it's suggested in connection with an increased collection of our sales tax. Government is like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Because of our willingness to accept our responsibility for those less fortunate, welfare has offered government its greatest opportunity for growth. And there's serious discussion today by learned men granted the idea not only of helping those in need, but actually they tell us that perhaps we should explore the idea of actually divorcing income from the necessity to work, that there should be a guaranteed income for all with a central authority satisfying not only the people's needs, but their wants. Well, to quote the French philosopher de Tocqueville again, he warned that such a government would cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform. And thus the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided, until the nation is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which government is the shepherd. Well, can anyone deny that our limited government, with its decentralized powers, has given way to planners, and they've laid an increasingly heavy hand on every facet of our lives? The president is fond of quoting from 1 Isaiah, the 18th verse, "Come, let us reason together." Well, now, there's nothing unreasonable about that. It has a sort of a cozy, inviting sound. Come, let us reason together. But let your eyes drop down a few lines to the next verse or two. I'm sure that he doesn't quote this line aloud, but I'm sure he knows of it. If ye refuse, ye shall be devoured with the sword. Freedom is very fragile. We've only known a few moments of it in all of man's history, but most of those moments have been ours. Freedom is also indivisible. It isn't spelled with an S. You can't elect to be partly free. To give up some part of your freedom and keep some other part. Either you're free or you're not free. Now, there are those among us whose concern for all who lack material benefits prompt them to sacrifice without restraint the rights and freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution. Indeed, they would declare the Constitution itself outmoded in the interest of providing security for each individual. Now, I don't challenge their right to be heard. As long as they're honest and they don't lead others to believe that we can have both the great society and our inalienable rights as guaranteed by the Constitution. If ever we decide we need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we keep one line from the old. He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. And in the case of California, that's not easy to do. This administration has added 50,000 employees in just the last few years. You realize in this country that it only takes 10 doctors for every 10,000 people in this country to keep us well and healthy. It only takes 11 lawyers to handle our legal problems. Only takes about 37 mechanics and oil station attendants to keep all our cars running for each 10,000 people. But it takes 130 federal employees to minister to our affairs and our needs. Government-owned corporations compete with privately owned business. They've lost $81 billion in so doing. That's more than a fourth of the national debt. The average American businessman has 2,700 government forms to fill out each year. It's been estimated that 35% of the businessman's time is spent completing this government-ordered paperwork. And it is also estimated it costs American industry $20 billion a year, added to the consumer price. And it takes another $7 billion at the government end for the handling of that paperwork. Some years ago, to give you an illustration of how this can happen, Freeport, Maine, joined with a lot of other communities in our nation, perhaps even your own, for the program of distributing food surpluses, federal food surplus, to the needy citizens. Now, no one could disagree with this idea, that we could produce so much of fiber and foodstuff that it was rotting in warehouses, and of course it was a logical idea to give it to those people in need. But in Freeport, they discovered, as in many other communities, that they were increasingly smothered under a load of federal demanded audits and reports and other paperwork, until one day Freeport, Maine woke up and discovered they had enlarged their city staff so much to handle this paperwork in connection with this supposed free federal program that it was actually cheaper for the city to cancel the program and buy the food in the local groceries and give it to the people. So they've withdrawn. Undaunted, government has declared war on poverty. In getting the program passed, I'm sure all of us are aware of the fact that West Virginia became a household word. We were told here was the classic example of poverty and distress. You almost could believe that we were going to fight the entire war against poverty right there in West Virginia. They were the prime reason and need for getting the program adopted. So now we have it. And West Virginia gets $400,000. Texas gets $10 million. Now maybe we need some target practice to identify the enemy. Gum Springs, Virginia has been handed a $74,000 award, $54,000 for administrator salaries and $20,000 for the poor. Maybe West Virginia was lucky after all. 2 years ago, the Area Redevelopment Agency decided to help West Virginia. They decided that a furniture factory was what was needed, that in this particular area, it could provide about 100 jobs. Of course, it was superfluous for them to inquire into whether there was any market or need for the product that would be produced. So, $2 million almost was put up by ARA, and then another $1 million was poured in by federal aid. They persuaded the West Virginia Industrial Development Authority to add $134,000. The local banks pitched in $75,000, and the local citizens in the area were invited to invest some $220,000 of their own individual savings. And now it's closed. There was no business, there was no market, there are now no jobs, and there were no profits. And someone can pick up a defunct business and a brand new factory building for quite a bargain price in West Virginia. No one would disagree with the humanitarian goal of the youth portion of our poverty program. The idea of salvaging, if possible, those young men and women who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet the responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. But let's take a look at how we're approaching that problem. In nearby Los Angeles, a 13-story hotel has been taken over as a home for the young women who will be trained for a year, salvaged so that they can then take their place in society. And we're going to spend $7,000 a year on each young person that we're helping. There are a lot of American families that are raising fine, productive citizens every day on incomes of less than $7,000 a year. And something is fearfully wrong in such a program when we find that the young man that we're going to help under this program is actually receiving more pay than your son receives if he puts on the uniform and goes to Vietnam to defend his country today. Congressman Okonski of Wisconsin shocked his fellow congressmen when he told an anecdote concerning two young men from his own district. They are brothers. One brother, a high school graduate, is in Vietnam for $78 a month in uniform. His brother, a dropout, was arrested for beating their mother, and he's now getting $200 a month pushing a power mower for the poverty program. I'm sure all of us are agreed that we have a moral responsibility to provide shelter for those who, through no fault of their own, lack adequate housing. But now a bill has been passed to subsidize the payment of rent and make it possible for people, in some cases even up to incomes of $10,000 a year, to be eligible for such a subsidy, to live in homes and neighborhoods beyond their means with their thrifty new neighbors contributing to their rent. Our traditional laws of eminent domain have recognized the occasional need for government to seize an individual's property upon payment of a fair price. And only if the government, with the citizen having his day in court, can prove that there is a clear and present need that can only be satisfied in the public good and the public interest for this particular piece of property. But now a variety of programs have diluted public interest. It's anything a few government planners decide that public interest should be. We adopted a program in 1949 to quickly provide decent homes for every American and eliminate slums. No one again could quarrel with this humanitarian purpose. But in a 10-year period, we've destroyed under that program 126,000 low-rent housing units. We've replaced them with a scant 28,000 at a higher rate of rent. We've left almost 1 million people displaced and no provision for finding shelter. They're finding it in new slums, paying a higher rent. And in the meantime, to show the contrast between the private and public sectors, the private building industry was building 27 million housing units in that 10-year period. Now, this law says that the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But if standard housing in convenient locations at rents they could afford had been available, they would have already moved into them without waiting for a government program and a bulldozer to shove them over. Robert Weaver, Federal Housing Commissioner, has stated publicly that the government in the beginning gave the people in this country the right to the land, the control of the land, in order to speed its development. Now, some of us, of course, figured that the people actually were here and created the government themselves, and they had possession of the land before the government was created. But now, Mr. Weaver says, the policy of the government is going to be for the government to regain complete control of the use of the land. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over American farms, surveying from the air to see if there have been violations of the planting allotments. And if so, the farmer is fined without a day in court. And if he can't pay the fine, his property is sold at auction to enforce the payment. For every dollar that we spent in the farm program on price stabilization in 1948, we are today spending $25. And with what result? Well, the farmer is getting 37 cents out of the market basket dollar, the lowest he has ever received in history. 2 million farmers have been moved to the city in search of jobs, and we're told that 2.5 million more should leave the soil and go to the city. Last year, the farm expenditures increased $200 million, and farm income dropped by a similar amount. With one voice, the government tells us the small farm is uneconomical, that it has to go, that only the large commercial farm now is needed. But with another voice, the government still insists on maintaining the 160-acre limitation on land that is receiving federal irrigation water. And with what arrogance do we see the federal government? I'm sure many of you are familiar with the nearby county and the problem now in the Imperial Valley. When they started the irrigation program 30-odd years ago, this was a private irrigation program. And the government wanted in. It had its own water needs, and it asked for permission to join with them. And the government, for doing so, wrote a contract and agreed that the people in the Imperial Valley would not be limited to the 160-acre size on their farms. And now they are violating the contract, and the government has notified the farmers in that valley that as of January 1st, they'll be down to 160 acres or no more water. And no voice is raised in Sacramento in behalf of the citizens of California. Just as no voice was raised with regard to that ridiculous decision canceling the Bracero program. Unfortunately, when Washington sneezes, Gesundheit is heard in Sacramento. Secretary Wirtz, who proved to be something less than a jolly green giant, promised to take care of California's harvest needs with schoolboys. But the school bell rings in September when the California need for crop pickers reaches its height. Some 400,000 workers will be needed. The governor issued something of a statement the other day. He said the secretary is doing a difficult job. He says it's different from what our Department of Employment thinks should be done, but he could be right. I think he's wrong, but he could be right. Now there is the ringing voice of leadership. The type of voice that... And at the same time, Attorney General Katzenbach, who has the power over immigration, overruled his fellow member of the cabinet, Secretary Wirtz, and ruled that in Florida, the West Indian laborers there should be allowed to remain and help with their crops. He said the president was having enough trouble in Vietnam without adding Florida to his worries. But now the food prices have reached an all-time high, and we're told that bad weather and drought is the reason. Now the dominoes begin to fall. California is the producer of 70% of all the tomatoes that go into canned tomatoes. Reduced, the plantings in California reduced by one-third. The price goes up. The loss to California farmers is over $20 million. And the loss to labor is felt in canning companies, some of them with the finest trademark names who've been moving to Mexico and setting up shop down there. Strawberries are up 30%, asparagus is up 25%, iceberg lettuce is up 180%, and we're just beginning. Meanwhile, the network of rules grows more minute. You know, there's a fellow runs an oil station down in the Mason-Dixon line, right on a highway where the tourists from the north visit the south. And he's a pretty enterprising fellow. He gets this tourist trade. He's got a little triangle of ground between the sidewalk and the driveway. And you know, a lot of stations, they cover that with gravel. Not him. He planted some cotton bushes in that little triangle. And when the northerners come in, the tourists, he picks a cotton bowl, and with their purchase of gas, he gives them a souvenir of their visit to the south. He has just been fined by the federal government for planting cotton without an allotment. Are we safe in our books and records? The post office has revealed to congressional committees that the Internal Revenue Service has been receiving private mail that the postal authorities are winnowing out of the mail when it is addressed to people who are behind or delinquent in their tax payments. Almost every county in California finds welfare taking more than a half of the total budget. Not too long ago, Tulare County announced that welfare spending in the first 9 months of this year was more than double the total amount they had budgeted for the year. Most of this is because of regulations forced on the states by the federal government and in turn by the state on the county, where there's little or no power to put sensible rules into effect. Do we think honestly that we no longer should teach the simple virtues of reward for labor or to repay when we borrow? Here in California, in a small college town, the local Rotary Club has contributed to a fund, and they attempt to help this college by lending money to poor college students, no interest, and the college student doesn't have to pay it back until after graduation, after he's established in a job. The other day, the dean of the college called them and said, if you're not willing to make this fund an outright gift, we won't need it anymore because the government's putting up the money and the students don't have to pay it back. Now the states find themselves creating culture bureaus because Washington is going to subsidize art and literature. The idea is to have two czars at the federal level with the power to distribute millions of dollars on the basis of their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art and literature. Well, maybe I'm unduly perturbed, but if they follow the pattern the government has shown in its government-sponsored scientific research, there's some reason for concern. Now, you understand, I don't pose as a scientist. I know very little about science. As a matter of fact, the paperclip's still something of a mystery to me. But sometimes I figure we're just subsidizing plain intellectual curiosity when I see the government spending tens of thousands of dollars on research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only thing I understand in that is that phrase, in the middle. There, I know who they're talking about. Now the nation's capital concerns itself with recreational facilities and our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors. They have a new booklet out by the Special Engineering Services Branch of Environmental Engineering and Food Protection of the United States Public Health Service. That isn't the book, that's the name of the agency publishing it. 134 pages of profundities. I don't know how we got along without them. For example, this book tells us if you lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such a height that the drinking level is convenient for the persons using the fountain. But wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. Insects crawling into the ears of outdoorsmen sometimes create painful conditions. I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But this isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that one by ourselves. Inflation, deliberately planned by our federal government, has reduced the power or the value of the dollar in the last three decades to 35.5 cents. In the last 20 years, it has eroded the value of our savings and our insurance by $190 billion. I can remember my father, when I was a boy, saying that the country needed a good 5-cent cigar. What this country needs is a good 5-cent nickel. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the productive free economy than any society has ever done without ruin. Our government practices bookkeeping tricks that would jail a private citizen if he tried them. We're told that we will have a $5 billion cut in the excise tax, and none of us can object to that. But at the same time, we are told that the deficit for the current year was only $3.5 billion, greatly reduced from what we feared it would be. But the Treasury Department at the same time publishes in the financial pages of the daily paper a statement that we have added in this same year $7 billion to our debt, with only a $3.5 billion deficit. Now, maybe figures don't lie, but perhaps someone's lying about the figures. At the state level, all of the bills go up for our necessary services because of this federally created inflation. Wearily, we find ourselves looking around for new sources of revenue. But when we suggest tax reform, it turns out to be the old shell game. Rearrange it. Apply it somewhere else. Spread it around. Try to convince the people they're getting a break under the idea that we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, we'd better take another look. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul because Peter has long since become bankrupt. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can reduce taxes without reducing the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. And now, in an atmosphere of emergency and excessive zeal, our federal government proposes to invade an area that traditionally has been the province of the local community in the state. We have the finest public school system in all the world. And at the same time that the federal government authorities deny they intend any federal control, they deny every suggestion for solving what financial problems we might have at the local level by tax credits for education costs or remitting tax revenue directly to the school board or the local school district. No, they tell us we must go to the federal government where there will be strings attached. And in spite of this, there has been competent evidence presented to congressional committees by some of the most learned men in education and school administration that there are no problems in the local school system that cannot be met at the local and state level. We've built $30 billion worth of classrooms in the last 10 years without federal help. We've reduced the ratio of pupils to classrooms and pupil to teacher. We've increased the average teacher's salary 65%, and we've increased school revenue 156%. Last year, the American voters voted the largest school bond issue in history, and yet, right now, while they're still trying to get more federal aid, there are already 135 separate federal agencies and offices doling out money to colleges. And at the opposite end of the spectrum now in the poverty program, they're going to begin with the kindergarten. Of the two, I'm a lot happier to have the government engaged in finger painting and playing in the sandbox. When a group of college presidents, alarmed with the threat to academic freedom inherent in federal handouts to colleges, went to Washington and proposed a plan whereby you and I as private citizens could financially aid the colleges through a tax deduction program without involving the government as a middleman, a Freudian slip occurred. Over and over again, they asked Francis Keppel, the United States Director of Education, why their plan would not work. And finally, he said, "You don't understand. With your plan, the government could not achieve its social objectives." Social objectives. If the government is going to build the schools and buy the books and grant the scholarships and make judgments and exert pressures, what if one day that pressure is of a political nature not to our liking? Education is the bulwark of freedom. But when you remove it too far from the parents' control and the local community, it becomes a tool of tyranny. 100 years ago, this nation was faced with the problem of being half slave and half free and whether such a nation could survive. And today the world is half slave and half free, and we're faced with the problem of whether mankind himself can survive. We call out to the guard to ask if all goes well, and back echoing from the Potomac on the night wind comes the answer, "There's nothing to fear." Nothing to fear. Nothing but an evil enemy who, since World War II, has increased the enslavement from 8% of the world's population to almost 40%. Every lesson of history tells us that as a nation has grown in culture and refinement, it has softened. And when confronted by the less cultured, in every case, the barbarians have triumphed. Well, you and I have come to our moment of destiny. We can't meet the problems of a divided world or nation with a splintered party. I speak now directly to Republicans. For too long, we've been Republicans with descriptive adjectives and hyphens, liberal Republicans, moderate Republicans, conservative Republicans, whatever adjective we wanted to use. The truth of the matter is, we've been sucker Republicans. Those adjectives and those hyphens were given to us by our opponents, and it's high time we bundled them up and gave them back and started just being Republican Republicans. We can cringe in the shadow of a philosophy we detest but fear to challenge, or we can rise from this defeat and begin the second round of our struggle to restore the Republic. I think we should be a party of opposition. Opposition to the misguided leadership at home, and opposition to all the evil abroad that threatens the dignity and freedom of man in every land and every country of the world. We can't do it by trying to outpromise our opponents. There are those, and I know well-meaning, so hungry to return once again to office, so hungry for victory, that they talk cynically of voter blocks and political expedience to attract them. Well, let me suggest there is a voter bloc, one that crosses party lines, racial and religious and ethnic and economic lines. It's a bloc of voters that's made up of unsung heroes. They get up in the morning and send their kids to school. They go to work and they pay their bills. They contribute to their church and their charity and their local community. They believe they were created in God's image and that God is the make creator of all of their rights and freedoms. And they're disturbed because their children can no longer ask God's blessing in a school cafeteria. Well, that block of voters can be ours for the asking if you and I are willing to stand on principle, to tell them, yes, we want to solve the problems of hunger and health and old age and every kind of misery, and we believe we can solve those problems without resorting to complete compulsion and without fiscal irresponsibility, that we believe we can put a floor beneath every citizen below which no American shall be asked to live in degradation. But we can do this at the same time without erecting a ceiling above which no citizen will be allowed to rise without being penalized for his initiative and his effort. Let us tell them that we won't buy our protection from the threat of the bomb by trading away and giving away freedoms of people in other lands not ours to give. And let's tell those unsung heroes in America that if their sons are to be asked to die for their country, they'll at least die knowing that they had a chance to try for victory. Thomas Wolfe said, to every man his chance. To every man, regardless of his birth, this shining golden opportunity. To every man the right to live, to work, to be himself, and to become whatever his manhood and his vision can combine to make him. This is the promise of America. An earlier generation of Americans pledged their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor to give us our freedom and that promise. Americans since have paid with their lives and their fortunes, but all of them have preserved their honor. We pray devoutly, devoutedly, as I'm sure they prayed, those earlier Americans, that we shall not be called upon to make such a sacrifice. But one thing is certain, unless we're willing to make the same pledge those earlier Americans made, make it within the hearing of the enemy, then freedom will be lost in our lifetime. And our failure to meet our challenge will be recorded in a book yet to be written called The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. The pathway of history is littered with the bones of dead empires. If we're to follow, we'll have no decades or centuries for leisurely decay, because the enemy at our gates is combat lean and hard and hungry for everything we've created. We and we alone, in this moment of time, must make a decision as to whether freedom will perish from the earth. I would say tonight to every Democrat that he should give deep consideration and great thought to whether he believes that we can preserve the two-party system so essential to our freedom under the present circumstances. As a former Democrat myself, I would suggest that he ask himself if the leadership of his party has not strayed far afield from the principles that once guided that party. And to every Republican listening, I would say, look deep into your own hearts and ask yourself if there's any difference that you can possibly have with any other Republican in this moment that is more responsible than the challenge and the responsibility we have. If you are prepared to say this, then I think you should at the same time plan what it is you're going to say to your children and your children's children someday. in explaining to them what it was you found that was more important than freedom, because I think they're going to want to know. Thank you.